I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education for Wednesday, April 12th. And I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 5524, the Higher Education Coordinating Committee budget bill. And it looks like we have quite an agenda on the university front today. So I don't know if Mr. Cannon, if you would like to start it off, or if I should just call up the first two or three people on the list. Or they can bring themselves forward, and I will announce who they are based on who it looks like they are on the list.
Madam Chair, I think it would be good to recognize the chair of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, Neil Bryant, who's in the room, and I think I may have seen the vice chair. Uh-huh. Oh, there he is,
Mr. Oh, look at that.
Yes.
David, hello. Thank
good
you
morning.
All for being here. Good morning.
Good morning. Co-Chair Smith Warner, I'm Ed Ray, President of Oregon State University. I'm here on behalf of the public university presidents, two colleagues here. I'll ask them to quickly introduce themselves.
Good morning. Carmen Suarez, Vice President, Global Diversity and Inclusion for Portland State University.
Good morning. I'm Vice Chair of the Board of Trustees for Eastern Oregon University.
Mm-hmm. And I think I think you have the short straw. Flicker. Thank you very much for giving us this opportunity to meet with you. We do have material to present to you, but we're happy to respond to questions either as we go along or if you wish to call us back. We do have a number of colleagues who have compelling points to make, so we want to make sure that each of them has an opportunity to speak to you. What we're going to do today is provide information on where we've been, where we are as universities, what the future looks like. One of the things that you'll hear the universities talk about is how we developed our request for $100 million in additional funding, which at the moment, we don't have coming to us, so it's important for you to have an opportunity to hear how we put together the numbers that added up to the $100 million. And I think, in fairness, I could say I know there's a lot of conversation there always is around tuition increases that almost all of the universities would be able to go forward on a stable basis with tuition increases of 5% or less if we were able to get the money that we made the case that we do need. So if we go to the second slide, we want to start today by providing a kind of state of the state review for the public universities, giving you a look back, as I said, to where we've been, where we are, where we're going, and where we're forecasting to be in the coming years, which I think all of us are very interested in. There's increasing diversity among our students, faculty, and staff. It's something we've worked at that we're very proud of. The universities, in fact, now serve some 30,000 more students today than we did 20 years ago. So the system has continued to grow. As I've said, we've added to the diversity of our student and faculty populations, and many of those students, like myself, are first generation and frankly require additional support services to be successful, and that requires additional resources. That's part of the reason why additional resources are so important to us. We're also serving more low-income and first-generation students than in the past, and historically underrepresented student groups are a more significant part of our overall student population. Completion rates and support services are improving. We are making investments. I think, to its credit, HEC, when it first organized, asked us to be very clear about what we would do with revenue increases, and we've targeted and been very clear about our plans for increasing academic advisors, career counselors, support services, IT upgrades, faculty and staff to help students graduate more quickly and more certainly raise the percentages that we're able to graduate. We feel very positive and value the increasing number of students that we attract from all walks of life, but we need state investment if we're to keep pace with what I think we all aspire to, which is 40-40-20. I know you all saw the Oregonian op-ed about 40-40-20. I understand it is an aspiration. It doesn't drive the budget, but I think aspirations are important to have and important to focus on. Maybe more so in difficult times than in easy times. This is just a brief snapshot that illustrates how much enrollment has climbed over the last 20 years. These numbers are total FTE numbers and included elsewhere in material that's available to the committee are supplemental materials on student populations that are broken down in terms of residency by campus, so you can get more detail in that way. Carmen?
So what this slide shows us, and you would have seen this earlier from HEC's presentations, is that the enrollment for students of color has been steadily increasing since the year 2000, and it is projected to increase even further. And that, of course, is a good thing. Oregon's higher education system is becoming more and more representative of our population as a whole here in Oregon. So therefore, we really need to make sure that we have the services and supports in place so all these students have an opportunity for success, and in particular for completion of their degrees. Okay, this next slide shows students in Oregon's K-12 schools who qualify for the free and reduced lunch program as a percentage of total K-12 enrollment. And just about half of all students qualify. That's 50%, just under 50%, need to have lunch at school. That's a very sobering piece of data. So what this represents is a pipeline issue. As more low-income and underrepresented minority students graduate from Oregon high schools, they will funnel into Oregon's universities. As we see more of this intersection of these student characteristics, our greatest challenge, which is also a remarkable opportunity, is to make sure they complete their degrees and take their place as productive and contributing Oregonians. This is good for all of our own success, all of us together collectively. Without increased investment from the state, inadequate budgets will disproportionately impact these students.
I think if we go to this slide, what you'll observe is, and I think you got this in an earlier presentation from HEC,
not really.
But what it illustrates in a very simple way is in contrast to when you and I were in college. Even if a student receives full Pell Grant and Oregon Opportunity Grant funding, there's still a gap in being able to cover the full cost of tuition and fees. And even students who work at minimum wage jobs while attending school have trouble filling the gap between aid and the cost of attendance. To give you an example from Oregon State, our estimate is on average students have a gap that they've got to fill somehow beyond the support we're able to give them of about $7,000 a year. And for Pell-eligible students, as you would expect, the most disadvantaged economically, that gap is about $9,000 a year. So a pretty serious challenge.
And President Ray,
yeah.
Just to go back to that, and that number you mentioned, I'm sure, includes kind of room and board living costs, even though this chart does
everything.
Not.
Yeah, everything. Sort of the full cost of attendance. Absolutely.
Great.
And I'm sorry if that
no, that's,
wasn't clear.
It was clear from what you were saying, and I just wanted to point out that even though that wasn't on the chart, that was still
thank you. I appreciate
very clear
that.
What you were saying.
I also understand that you had a presentation yesterday on the financial support that the different universities give to student scholarship support, and I've talked to some others about it. That information was incomplete in the sense that it didn't include money that's spent in terms of remissions, where the university simply does not charge tuition, room and board to students, and it gets the resources back from uh, the HEC in terms of its overall budget. So it's a direct deduction we make from our revenues as opposed to monies that are transferred to us. And to give you a sense of the magnitude, I have no idea how the full accounting would work out. But for Oregon State University, we provided $12 million in remission support in 2006 and $36 million in 2014, so a huge increase. And again, I think the HEC staff, others can help to make certain that you have complete information. Not surprisingly, part of what's contained in these numbers are the programs that the various universities have. The U of O, for example, has Pathway Oregon, which covers full tuition and fees for any Pell-eligible, academically qualified Oregonian. Western Oregon University has the Western Tuition Promise, which guarantees undergraduates that they will be protected from, unfortunately, what are often unexpectedly high tuition increases. And OSU has its Bridge to Success program, which ensures that qualified students receive enough gift aid to cover their annual tuition and fees at OSU. At its peak, this program provided 3,200 Oregon undergraduates access to Oregon State University with no tuition and fees. In tougher times, when the Oregon Opportunity Grant funding is down or there are challenges with Pell eligibility for students, that number has fallen as low as 2,000 or 1,800. But again, it's a substantial number of students. These are the tuition remission programs that I referred to a moment ago, and they're funded entirely by the universities, and they're critical to protecting low-income Oregon students from the full force of the tuition increases that we've had over time and are likely to have in the future. Bobby?
Food insecurity hits students across the spectrum. It's not just a community college problem. And you can see from the statistics here that 60% of Western Oregon students were food insecure during the school year. 11,929 students participated in SNAP, and 133 Oregon families used student hours for employment-related daycare. Food security is insecurity is correlated with fair to poor health, lower grade point average, low income, and unemployment over time. And food insecurity in the college years can affect cognitive, academic, and psychosocial development. Rising college costs, an increase in low-income and first-generation families, students attending school, and the changing demographic trends are all factors. You can see, and you may be familiar with this slide from a previous HEC presentation, the dark blue at the bottom of the scale represents state funding. The light blue above it represents tuition. So as you know, we get less money, we spend less money on students, and yet still graduate high quality and high number of students compared to our national peers. We have to ask ourselves, who should pay for 40-40-20? Should it be the state or should it be the students? And you see the trend line there over the top of the data. The decline in public subsidies for higher education institutions has generated significant losses for both students and society. The worst outcome for everyone is when a student accrues debt and does not matriculate to a degree. That's why we must focus on sustaining and increasing the state investment, ensuring that universities are being efficient with our dollars, and driving funds into programs and student support services that ensure completion within 6 years. Almost a third of our students graduate with no debt, which is very important, but a vast majority of four-year graduates complete their undergraduate degree with a relatively modest and manageable amount of student debt. You can see here that 68% of public university students borrow, and that students most at risk of overborrowing are low income with little or no family help or borrowing experience, and they have depleted most of their types of aid before arriving at the university. it is equitable for students to pay a portion of the cost for their own education, and borrowing for college is a reasonable option. For most students, paying for college over time allows a significant boost in lifetime earnings. But that does not mean that any level of borrowing is reasonable. So with swelling enrollment, the total student debt is increased over the past two decades.
And Ms. Connor?
Yes.
May I just check on the Pell Grants? Just to clarify, is your eligibility a number of years or an amount of or a set amount of dollars? And you may not know that. I'm struck by that concept of folks running out of their Pell Grants before they get in, which I would assume is you've done community college or some other prior.
So it's both. To even be eligible for Pell Grants, you have to have a very low estimated income,
right.
Family income. And then it is limited to a certain amount of years, essentially. It used to be 5 years and the summers, and that got trimmed back to 4 years and no summers. And for many students, you may have seen in the news recently, there's two discussions, one about cutting Pell further and another about reinstating summer. There's a real struggle going on there.
Right. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah. Dr. Ray, something that I've been concerned about for a long time is the fact that rural kids that come from especially east of the mountains, mm-hmm. are much less likely to go to college. Mm-hmm. And that worked pretty well 100 years ago when they inherited the family farm and knew the skills that they had to have to run the farm or the ranch or whatever it be, but it's not the case anymore. These rural high school grads need higher education. So I, for one, have fought to keep Eastern Oregon afloat, supported the new campus in Bend, the Cascade campus for Oregon State, the community colleges that are available. But I still note that those rural kids are much less likely to go to college and get the higher education that they need. And they're almost perpetuating poverty because of their parents did not have a college education. They maybe don't see the real need for it and so on. I wondered how well we're doing at getting at that problem. I've identified the problem. You know it's true.
Well, I really appreciate it. Yeah, I appreciate the question, Co-Chair Monroe. As you say, students from rural communities often, if they go to college, would be the first in their family to go because the college-going rate is so low. They often live in very difficult financial circumstances as families, and they're among the ones we're reaching out to, first-generation Pell eligible. We could spend a lot of time with me talking about the University Innovation Alliance. It's a collaboration of 11 major public universities, including Oregon State, Arizona State, Ohio State, Purdue, Texas at Austin, Michigan State. We're all focusing on increasing the number of degrees that we generate, and particularly degrees among Pell-eligible students, which would include those from rural communities, obviously. And like you, I think that people tend to go to college overall at schools that are within 50 miles of where they live or grew up. And so it's really important to have campuses like Eastern Oregon University, like the campus that we're trying to grow at OSU Cascades, yeah. Like Southern Oregon University, which clearly serve largely rural communities where the college-going rates are much too low if we're to break the cycle of poverty. Absolutely. We're working on it.
Are we making progress?
I think we are. I think we are. So, for example, let me stick with the simple example. So 30,000 feet, this University Innovation Alliance. We came together, the 11 universities, 4 years ago. We committed to graduating 68,000 more students than we individually anticipated graduating before we came together by helping each other develop sound practices. That number has now grown. Our projection is that we'll have 94,000 more by 2025, and we've set the condition that half of those graduates, new graduates, need to be Pell-eligible students. So we're being very specific and targeting those who really have been marginalized and left out historically.
One little follow-up.
One
of the programs that we have been supporting the last few years is Aspire, which is designed to encourage students that don't have the kind of family support to think about higher education and college. I remember when I first got into government here 40 years ago, I looked at the numbers about Eastern Oregon University, for example, and I thought, man, just to have enough students to keep going, they have to give in-state tuition to kids from Idaho and Washington. What's, you know, that's not good. And but I have totally flip-flopped and changed my attitude about making a higher education available to those kids east of the mountains. Learned that, you know, it's scary for them to pick up and move to Eugene or Corvallis or Portland. They don't want to do that, so we need to have those institutions available where they live, near where they live, and we need to have programs like Aspire that that encourage them, help them to understand what they can get out of a higher education and why they need to think about it, even though their parents maybe never went to college and they live on a farm.
No, absolutely, and I think programs like the Eastern Promise, like the Western Promise, are efforts to really encourage people to take advantage of the opportunities that are there for them. I remember about 10 years ago, we have an orientation the first week, as most schools do, and we had a big celebration on the quad by the MU for students to sign up for organizations and so forth. I was talking to this young lady who came from Eastern Oregon, a very small town, and I sort of, you know, feeling proud of what we were putting on, I said, "What do you think?" And she said, "There are more people here than I have ever seen in one place in my entire life." So it's not inconsequential that people from remote areas can be terribly intimidated if their only choices are to go away to large universities. Yeah. I think places, as I said, like Eastern, Southern, the Cascades campus, they play a tremendously important role in helping us better serve rural populations, absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Certainly. Go ahead.
If I can go on the next slide, we want to talk a little bit about investment in higher education. And for all of us, investment is really about student success and the quality of the education that they're able to get at public universities. I announced to 725 or so people at a luncheon in early February that we're launching a student success initiative. We're working with our foundation to raise $150 million over the next 3 years to help us increase retention rates, six-year graduation rates, eliminate achievement gaps among subgroups of student populations, and I know that colleagues at other universities have similar programs. So when we think about the prospect of not getting the $100 million that we're asking for, we're really talking about taking a step back on many things that we know will help students be successful. As Bobby said earlier, the worst tragedy is someone who goes to college, doesn't graduate, and the only piece of paper they have is the loan debt that they've got to pay off because they've got the debt and they don't have the capacity to earn the income to pay it off. So for us, investment by you and your colleagues in higher education really is about student success and the quality of our programs. And when the state disinvests in higher education, there are consequences both on campus, inside the classrooms, and also for the state of Oregon as a whole. Just to give a few examples of the consequences of disinvestment, Internally at universities, we're forced to cut academic advisors and student services, even though we need them now more than ever. We lose career connections and opportunities for experiential learning like internships. We increase reliance on non-tenured faculty, and they're often extraordinary people, but they're not at the level of expertise of our tenure track faculty. And the backlog of deferred maintenance that all of us are wrestling with on our campuses just grows more than it otherwise would if we had resources to attend to them. Oregon's economy and workforce also suffers. In the 21st century, skills have become the most important currency in the job market. Today, workers need the right post-secondary preparation to gain a foothold and prosper in the labor market. Employers need highly skilled post-secondary talent in order to remain competitive, and communities need both a highly skilled workforce and a competitive business sector in order to build attractive places to live and work and study.
So we're going to spend the next couple of slides taking a look at how and why a bachelor's degree from a four-year university will yield dividends for students and young adults. And please don't let anyone tell you that going to college isn't worth it. And it is many times over. In 2014, 31% of adults 25 and older in Oregon held a bachelor's degree. And only 37% of youth were enrolled in some sort of post-secondary education. This is the fourth lowest in the country. We can and should do better than this when we look at all the benefits our students can gain, Oregon can gain, and society can gain when Oregonians have a degree. A 2014 study conducted by Pew showed that when it came to attitudes towards work, employed millennial college graduates are more likely than their peers with a high school diploma or less education to say that their job is a career or a stepping stone to a career. That would be 86% versus 57%. In contrast, millennials with a high school diploma or less are about three times as likely as college graduates to say their work is just a job to get them by, 42% versus 14%. The survey also finds that among employed millennials, college graduates are significantly more likely than those without any college experience to say that their education has been very useful in preparing them for work and a career, 46% versus 31%. And these better educated young adults are more likely to say that they have the necessary education and training to advance their careers, 63% versus 41%. But we ask ourselves, do these benefits outweigh the financial burden imposed by four or more years of college? Among millennials aged 25 to 32, the answer is clearly yes. About 9 in 10 altogether, those one with a bachelor's degree say college has already paid off, 72%, or will pay off in the future, an additional 17%. Even among the two-thirds of college-educated millennials who borrowed to pay for their schooling, almost 9 in 10, 86%, say their degrees have been worth it. And there's a very recent study released last week by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York that shows that bachelor degree recipients enjoy home ownership more frequently than associate degree holders do, and that both groups, the bachelor's degree holders and the associate degree holders who have no debt, enjoy home ownership at higher rates than their counterparts who graduate with debt. The statistics in this study show that by age 33, those who graduated from college with no debt own homes at a rate above 45%, whereas those who graduated with debt owned homes at just under 45%. Those who did not attend college owned homes at a rate of between 25 and 30%. Significant gap. The gap in home ownership between college graduates from families with above mean incomes versus below mean incomes is much smaller.
just above and below 45% respectively, than the gap between non-college attendees from the same groups, about 32% versus 26% respectively. Students who went to college, irrespective of the amount of income they started with, their family income, have actually very similar home ownership rates. And then this next slide. This is a slide we like to feature a lot. It shows that graduates from Oregon's universities exceed the national average for postgraduate income. That's something we should all be proud of and work to ensure doesn't change. So we put it together with career satisfaction. We put it together with career advancement. We put it together with their income levels. We put it together with home ownership. There's also an economic engine that feeds right back into Oregon.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah. You'll notice, though, all of them exceed the norm, but the two that are the lowest are Eastern and Southern institutions that serve more rural parts of the state, predominantly more rural parts of the state. So although they're still ahead by going to college, they're not doing quite as well as the average students from the more urban universities.
Yeah, and Senator Moreau, if I can make a point of personal privilege, I know some of you remember Martha Ann Dow, a remarkable woman. Yeah. Klamath Falls is not exactly New York City. I grew up in New York City. It's not New York City.
Yes.
And they do very well there. And it was really Martha Ann's vision that by focusing on careers associated with health care and health services, that OIT has really made an incredible transformation. And I think maybe there's a lesson there for all of us to think about how can we, at individual institutions, identify market niches or areas where we could excel, and I don't know that we could replicate such terrific results, but get the kinds of results that you're talking about, regardless of where they're located, because you wouldn't automatically think of Klamath Falls as a place in which you would grow degrees in healthcare professions. It took somebody with some vision to see a pathway and the possibilities, and there's no saying we can't do that elsewhere.
But, Madam, just follow up. But OIT is CTE on steroids. I mean, it the programs that they teach there are programs that lead directly to more technical and higher paying jobs. Mm-hmm. So it's marvelous success there. I wish we could replicate it all over the state.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Senator Rubin.
I just want to make a comment though as well. You make choices, and where your graduates end up sometimes is a big difference. And a lot of OIT kids are all over the place. I mean, they train them to go all over the place. And many of us in rural areas would love a lot of our students to stay there. Mm-hmm. And so we focus on industries that are in our areas. And if you look at the distribution of wealth and how people make a living, in each of those places, the cost of living is a little lower, and the kinds of jobs available, if we keep our kids at home, don't pay as well as they do if they want to go to urban. So there are some other reasons why that chart looks the way it does. Mm-hmm. OIT made a decision, and a lot of their kids go other places. They aren't going to get the jobs there. It has built some industry in their local area that's been helpful, but we don't want to forget that we want higher educated people in all parts of our state, mm-hmm. and some of these regional duals are producing those people that stay there and make a better living than the average, even though they're in places where the average wealth is much less. Yeah. So I just, you know, I think there are niches for each of them, and I would like that to happen, but I don't want every university to capitalize on only those jobs that move all of our kids right into the urban areas to take advantage of the.
So I think there is that challenge of how do you attract employers to where the populations are. And if you talk to employers, they'll tell you it's largely driven by whether they can find the skilled workforce that they need. Sure. So that's the challenge, is how do we bring businesses and industries to these rural communities so that they can thrive? It's not impossible, but I think it is impossible if you're disinvesting in higher education because you're not producing more skilled employees that businesses and industries could support in rural communities and everywhere else.
Thank you.
Okay, anyway, go ahead. Anyway, I guess to sort of move quickly, there are others who certainly have a lot to say to you. Higher education obviously provides much more for people than improved employment and earnings outcomes, as important as they are. It also prepares more engaged, active, and healthier citizens. Bachelor's degree holders are 2 times more likely than their counterparts to volunteer in their communities, and 47% more likely to have health insurance. They're more likely to vote and are considerably less reliant on government programs and services than those with high school degrees. An engaged civil society is critical to the foundation of the democratic system and way of life that we have. And college helps to sustain and improve that foundation, something we all ought to be more than willing to invest in. Thank you. That concludes our...
Thank you. Three. Representative Lively?
And so I'm not expecting an answer, and maybe Mr. Cannon has already provided me this information. I've lost it. When you showed the chart about who's in school, the trend for in-state for our local students is down some, and I understand there's reasons potentially why that is or not, and the out-of-state is up, and I understand that too. But my concern goes back to the longer term, and we tend to deal in two-year cycles here, but I'm more concerned about how we stabilize the system and going forward. So I'd like to understand a little bit more about, you know, the number of high school graduates, what the expectation is. So as the high school graduates growing, so the expectation is we have more in-state students if we could control costs. I'm just trying to see out past this where we're going, because it concerns me if the trend's going to continue down. From my standpoint, the priority needs to be our in-state students, if fewer and fewer in-state students are going to participate in a higher education for multiple reasons.
So let me touch on three factors. One is, I believe, and I know that Ben and his colleagues could provide you with more concrete data, is that high school graduates in this state, as year to year, is now pretty flat and is expected to stay pretty flat for a number of years into the future. So that means if you want more Oregonians getting college degrees, you got to do a better job in rural communities, in urban low-income areas, yeah, with first generation, with people of color, all of the populations that we know the future of this country rests very heavily on. A second issue is where are we with respect to providing support for Oregonians to get an education? The reality is that, and we all know it, that to sustain the efforts of the universities to provide quality education to everybody, we have to be able to attract out-of-state and international students financially, as well as for the purpose of building a more inclusive, diverse community. We need those resources because the state, at least to this point, has not been able to step up and provide the support per student FTE. You saw how the numbers have changed that would be needed for us to be able to make budgets sustainable even as we increase the numbers of students who we are able to attract from rural Oregon. We're in an interesting fix at Oregon State, and this would be a longer conversation, but I committed, and my board has reaffirmed, that because we were created as the state's university to serve the people of Oregon and then the nation, the world as well, that we would not let our undergraduate enrollment of Oregonians fall below 2/3. Right now it's about 73% in Corvallis. As a result, I've got a $20 million problem I have to solve if we don't get more money out of this legislative session. And so the more we're kind of torn both ways. We all want to educate more Oregonians, and the more of a commitment we make, the more vulnerable we are to the kind of situation the state finds itself in now, where the resources are simply not there. So I can tell you, I'm conflicted. My board is very conflicted, thinking about how do we most immediately serve the needs of Oregonians, even as the state seems to be incapable of providing the financial partnership that would make it all sustainable over time.
Thank you. And I appreciate, Dr. Ray, your efforts at Oregon State to address that, even though it's costing you money, but I appreciate that.
Okay. Rep. Wisnett, another question for this panel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Wright and ladies, thank you for your presentations. Also, I'll have to take time to tell President Wright and Ben, we really appreciate Central Oregon, your support and leadership on the OSU Cascade campus. However, I'm going to turn around a little bit here, 180. I'm the only member of this committee sitting on policies. I've heard a lot of what we're hearing today, and I do have a commitment, so I may not be able to spend the whole time here. I flipped ahead to the last slides. I've been in education policy for over 10 years of my career, legislative career. I still believe the biggest cost drivers are transferability of credits and 6 years to graduate. We've already heard that today. I'm going to be asking and demanding to know what the university presidents are doing to address those cost drivers. It doesn't take a lot of statistics to figure out if you stay 6 years, you're going to spend at least $25,000 extra for room and board. And you're coming out with a $30,000 loan. So that would pay off if we can graduate in 4 years or 3 years. And it happens for people. We have a bill in the policy committee coming down about the transferability. Since I've been here, we're going to solve this transferability. We don't solve it. We keep having studies and studies and studies about transferability. In our presentation in this committee, 54% of people transferring from community college lose credits. 20% lose more than 15 credits. We need your leadership. We need action on this. And then I flip to the next to last slide, and Mr. President, all of your cost drivers went up significant. Salary and pay, 6.8. Health care, 9.7. Retirement, 21%. That's more than the average cost of inflation, Mr. President. Supplies, 4%. We need in this committee help to bring down the cost. I've worked for affordability and access increase, which comes with affordability. We need your help and we need your leadership to address cost drivers and why it's taken 6 years to graduate. And I think that's transferability affects that, sir. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Wisnett. If I could respond very quickly, we don't control the cost drivers. 70% of our costs are people. When we were allowed to have our own individual boards, we were told, you will stay in PEB, you will stay in PERS, and you will negotiate as a group with SEIU. We had no latitude to do anything about what are, in fact, the major cost drivers that we face. In terms of the transferability issue, we got to get past feel good. We got to get past accrediting and credentialing course credits that students take that may or may not match up with the academic standards needed for them to be successful in subsequent courses. We have degree partnerships with each of the 17 community colleges in the state. We have college pathway programs with Jefferson High School and Lebanon High School. I meet with superintendents of the surrounding six districts constantly talking about what can we do to accelerate students making it through the education pipeline. And as you pointed out, the most important thing we could do is to improve time to degree. You can't improve time to degree if you're letting adjunct faculty go, if you're having to eliminate tenure-track faculty positions, if you're having to cancel majors and cut back on course offerings at times that students need to be able to take them if they're going to graduate in a timely way. So part of what all of us are wrestling with to different degrees is not just the tuition question, but what do we do on the operational side that doesn't undercut our ability that all of us are working on to speed up time to graduation. That is the most powerful way we could reduce the debt problem for students, by speeding up time to degree, and we need the resources to be able to do it. We didn't give you a figure of $100 million on a whim. That's what we believe we need to continue on the path we've started.
Thank you. So I have Rep. Parrish, and I just want to point out we have two more panels and 30 more minutes.
Okay, thanks. Well, first of all, I would love to let you out of PEB. happy to do that. I have been walking down memory lane when we crashed a healthcare committee in 2011 over letting people out of OEB. So I'm all about giving you that flexibility. I think that's absolutely important. One thing I think, though, that can be addressed that I heard in your testimony this morning that has me a little bit frustrated is that when we confer a degree on an Oregon high school, a diploma on an Oregon student, and that school, a school that the child came from, may or may not have gotten them academically prepared to go to your school because of your own admissions requirements. And I heard you say, well, graduation's flat, we need to do more to lift the graduation. My frustration lies in the fact that a high school diploma does not mean, if a child is otherwise academically qualified with SAT scores, a good essay, and a good GPA, but if they missed coursework, that they could be denied to an Oregon university. That has me as a parent pretty upset. And I get that community college could be a route, but it's not necessarily a route for every kid, and for other reasons, they may want to start and be in our Oregon university system. I think we need to make that seamless. I'm willing to work on that with universities in the interim, but I think we need to get to one standard of admissions that an Oregon diploma, with, when you've got a academically qualified child, allows kids to apply and be received into an Oregon university. So I'd like to see us address that. I think that's something we can do in the flexibility of you all having your own independent boards. I voted for you to have independent boards, so I think that that's critical. So that's more comment. You don't have to answer that today, but I'd like you to start thinking about that because I'm not happy about it. And I know that I've talked to parents who are not happy about that as well, and they feel like if their child gets that diploma, that should mean that, you know, it transfers over into our university system. The one thing I do want to ask you is the governor came out yesterday and said she wants to hold you all to 5% tuition increase. How do you expect that you're going to be able to do that?
Well, I honestly think there needs to be a quid pro quo, and I know the governor mentioned in her letter that she was hopeful that more could be done before session closes to provide more operating support to the universities. She could have proposed more in the first place. The state budget is up about, I don't know, 8%. We're flat. So if anyone thinks they're investing in higher education over time, you're not. We're not even getting a proportional increase to what is available in terms of the overall budget. I'd like to see some movement in terms of operating funds. I think the governor would like to see that as well. She felt she had to start where she started. I get it, but you all are very important players in terms of what monies are available and where those monies go. I hope you'll find a path that actually represents net new investment in higher education. We know how to use those monies to get the kind of results you want. The other thing I'd mention quickly is you talked about, you know, community college, you know, might be good for some, but it's not the obvious pathway for everybody going forward. And that's apart from the issue of I want everything accredited that's certifiable. So courses coming out of high school need to be judged by college-level faculty in terms of do these credits represent what they purport to represent. And I think that's where a lot of the challenge on transferability is. But I'll give you a great example. So a friend of the university has a grandson who's had very serious health problems each of the last 3 years of high school, missed lots of time. And the question was, you know, he wants to go to Oregon State like his grandpa, you know, is there anything you can do? And it's just not there on paper. But we have this degree partnership program. So, for example, what he will do is he will go to Lynn Benton Community College to get better college ready than he is now. He will live on the campus in the dorms. He will have access to Dixon Hall. His financial and academic records will be kept at both places. It's a seamless partnership. We have the capacity to do that. Easiest, most easily, obviously, with Lynn Benton, because it's right there. For the others, it's more of a physical challenge. But we have that same ability to make that community college through the university to graduation about as seamless as we can figure out how to make it. So it's more of an opportunity, I think, perhaps, than is publicly realized and recognized.
Thank you. I'd like us to move on, please. Thank you all for your testimony.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm assuming the next three, Jamie Moffitt, Sukwant Jai, and Kella Hellyer? Or you can arrange yourself in some other order. Or Natalie Fisher, Susan Walsh, or Brian Fox can also come up if they care to. I'd be happy to get through all six of you at once.
A little OT.
Yes, please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you, co-chairs Smith, Warner, and Monroe. I'm Susan Walsh, Provost and Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at Southern Oregon University. Good morning to you all, and thank you for having us this morning. In this next section, we want to take a look back at some trends and changes in funding over time and review the impact of those decisions by universities and the legislature. And I think some of your questions, thank you, will be answered in this next section. And I think I can operate this. The cost of educating a student has not increased substantially over the last several decades. However, the price to obtain a degree has increased hand over fist. What's changed is who pays for college degrees and how much comes out of their pockets. State funding and tuition have an inverse relationship, like a teeter-totter demonstrated above. As one goes down, the other rises, and vice versa. This is a similar slide to one that you've seen in earlier HEC presentations. The difference is that we're showing even years, and I believe the HEC slide shows odd years. This is a demonstration of how clearly the change in cost has shifted from the state to the student. So in 1997, tuition made up less than half of a public university's revenue. Today, it's nearly three-fourths of the revenue on average. And this slide is showing you that as state general fund revenues have gone up, the percentage of the public university share has actually decreased significantly since the late 80s. The public university share includes all state general fund support, so that's PUSF, state programs, debt service, and statewide programs. The slide also shows pretty dramatically how overall revenue has gone up for the state, but universities clearly have not seen their share of increase proportionately. We know you all have tough choices. We appreciate the support that you've demonstrated in the past, especially in the last biennium when we were able to infuse student support programs with additional revenue. And we also know that there are many worthy programs. You've heard from the panelists a few minutes ago about the clear benefits to Oregon citizens, the economy and society when we prioritize higher education. And I thank you for your patience and time.
To the next slide. Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Smith Warner, Co-Chair Monroe, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jamie Moffitt. I'm the Vice President for Finance and Administration and Chief Financial Officer at the University of Oregon. And I will try to quickly, because I know you have a number of people, run through this next set of slides. What this slide shows is taking that trend from the Public University Support Fund and portraying it on a per fundable student basis. So you can see how much funding is coming through on average to the universities for each fundable student. We are very appreciative of the slight uptick that we've had in the last several years, or I should just say uptick. We're appreciative for any uptick in funding. The thing that's daunting, though, about this slide is that if you look at the figures from 15-16 on a per student basis of what we're receiving in that state support, that is actually lower than what we received in 06-07, and these figures are not adjusted for inflation. So over that time period that we're now receiving less funding per student, we've seen very significant increases in our PERS costs, our PEB costs, our labor costs, et cetera. Can you flip the slide? This next slide, I think some of you may have seen in other presentations. It basically represents where the state as a whole stands in terms of funding per student. The data lags a little bit because it's collected for the entire country. We were something like 46th in the country. My understanding is that we are going to be moving up because of the significant investment in last biennium. Again, we're very grateful for that. We'll be somewhere around 35 is what I've been told. But unfortunately, if we don't continue to see progress, it's very likely that we'll end up slipping back in terms of these numbers overall. The next slide I wanted to talk about was a little bit about some of the staffing pressures that we're facing. So we are doing everything we can to operate as effectively as and efficiently as possible. I'll just speak for a moment of my own campus, where last year we did about $6.3 million of cuts to try to operate more efficiently, both on the administrative and academic side. That did translate into, I think it was about 130 jobs that were affected by that. That being said, we do have pressures on our staffing around making sure that we are staffed appropriately to deal with issues of safety, issues of compliance, like Title IX investigators, and also to try to provide that support that President Ray talked about so that we have advisors and counselors and others, so that students aren't just coming to the university, they're actually getting the appropriate advice and counsel so that they're successful and that they're graduating, and hopefully graduating more like within 4 years than 6 years. We are making a big effort on that front. But I do want to be upfront and transparent about the fact that we are facing pressures that do lead to some areas where we have to add staffing to enable those students to be successful. The final page I'm going to touch about is just the impact to the universities if we end up with a public university support fund that is funded at the governor's recommended budget level. It will create a very, very difficult, as you've heard, situation for campuses. Each campus is a little bit different. We all have different financial pressures based on where we're located in the state, what our finances are. But I think I can say with confidence that across campuses at that level of funding, what you're going to see are tuition increases that are higher than anyone would want to have occur, as well as in many cases very, very significant cuts, which then go to the staffing levels that we can provide on campus.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that the governor's recommended budget is grossly inadequate, but you have to understand it anticipates nearly $1 billion new revenue. And I don't know where the 60% vote is in the House and the Senate for that much new revenue. We cannot anticipate until I see where the votes are that we can raise $1 billion in new taxes.
Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Smith-Warner, members of the committee, to respond, I do want to be clear that even the things I'm talking about are at the governor's recommended budget. So as our committee talked about tuition increases and the questions about where we're going to be, there was always that question. We would like to be much higher. We could end up lower. We don't know for sure. And I will share that that was part of the uncertainty that made the process very difficult on our campuses as we're all struggling with these questions. If there's time, I was going to talk a little bit about some of what's happening on different campuses, or are we feeling pressure and need to?
Are all four of the other people here? Because we actually have, the co-chair and I have a 9:45 with the big chairs, so we have a hard stop today.
Okay, then maybe what I'll, if we do have the other people here, what I will just summarize very, very quickly.
I want you guys to get what you want out of your full presentation. So.
Yeah. Okay, then I'm going to do a slightly shorter than I was going to do and just say that across the campuses, there are many, many campuses. Mine is one that's earlier in the process, so we have more concrete numbers where we are looking at tuition increases that are much more significant than what we would like. In our case, our campus put forward and our board approved a range of increases where it varies from anywhere from 5.1% to 10.6% depending on the funding we get. So one of the challenges was we have this uncertainty about what level of funding are we going to receive. I will just point out that in addition to that, we're looking at close to $9 million of cuts for our campus, which will affect, again, staffing and services. And this comes on top of $6.3 million of cuts that we did last year and is in addition to another probably $3.5 million of cuts that we're looking at in some of our academic units that have to deal with changes in enrollment and where students are being educated. So just as an example, that kind of shows one campus in terms of what's happening. But campuses are facing very, very similar issues, and each campus is trying to make an independent decision. You heard President President Ray talk about they're looking at a lower tuition increase this year, but potentially much higher cuts and then potentially a higher increase next year. So each campus is trying to struggle with these issues and deal with it and try to figure out how do you minimize the impact on the campuses so we can be successful with our core mission of educating these students. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chairs Monroe and Co-Chair Smith-Warner and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kella Hellyer. I'm the Director of Financial Aid at Western Oregon University.
Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Smith-Warner, for the record, my name is Sikfan Jaj. I'm a faculty member as well as Vice Provost for Academic Innovation and Student Success at Portland State University. The state funding picture for higher education since the late 1990s hasn't been rosy. That point has been made by my colleagues earlier. But last biennium, the legislature began to turn the tide and reinvested in Oregon's public universities in a big way. Thank you for that. Universities took that funding and drove it directly into financial aid and student support services. This trend is something we want to see continue, as we are still not back at the 2007 funding levels. This section will give you a very quick snapshot of the benefits of investment on each of our campuses. Next slide. So last biennium, you appropriated $665 million into the public support fund, which was a 28% increase from the biennium before. Let's take a look at what you got for investment in each of these campuses. At Portland State University, we were able to reduce the tuition increases and fee increases from 4.2% to 3.1%, the benefits of this work directly accrued to students. But more importantly, we were able to hire additional advisors, made additional investments, and reduce the advising ratio from 650 to 1 to 360 to 1. The mandated or maximum usually is 300 to 1. In addition to that, we have redesigned our advising model. This work is also supported by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the work we are doing in redesigning the advising model and seen as some of the most innovative practices in the nation. Many of the members that we are working with are part of the University Innovation Alliance that was mentioned earlier. At Southern Oregon University, we expanded the Pirates to Raiders program, which strives to ensure every Hispanic student in the Phoenix Talent School districts has the ability to access the college education through SOU. The program improves the college admission process for Hispanic families, increases the number of Hispanic students who earn a bachelor's degree and are an advanced degree, and encourages bilingual teaching. And the Jackson Josephine Pledge fall of 2016 to help high school students in the two-county area navigate the transition from high school to Southern Oregon University through the dual credit opportunity, early advising, reduced tuition, and wraparound student services. I know I'm flying through this, but these are just quick snapshots of the kind of good work that is happening in the universities.
It's very helpful. Thank you.
And further for Western Oregon University, some of the benefits of investment that we've seen is that there's been increased fee remissions by $1 million targeted towards specific Oregonian populations, including the Western Promise students, which was the fixed rate tuition, and the first generation students, rural students, and veterans. And then increased capacity, including hiring additional staff for WU's innovative early academic risk intervention program in academic advising and providing support for online access for student assistance in course support supported through Moodle, online access for student assistance in course, in Western's online open source learning platform. I'm just going to be picking out a couple of points on each of these. At University of Oregon, they were able to award graduation completion grants, providing grants to more than 100 juniors or seniors who had exhausted state and federal financial aid, and established the Tenure Track Faculty Initiative to increase tenured track faculty with an emphasis on STEM fields. A portion of these new faculty are funded by state investment. At Oregon Tech, they've been able to increase degree completion through completer scholarships of $1,200 each for 150 successful students who are close to graduation but at risk of dropping out due to financial hardship, and increased success for 120 first-generation and low-income students through targeted comprehensive advising and expanded peer consulting and mentoring, a 75% increase. At Oregon State University, they were able to grow enrollment of Oregon residents by over 350 students, and they invested in additional advisors and revamped courses with high failure or withdrawal rates. And at Eastern Oregon University, they were able to provide access and success to rural and underserved students, providing student support to multicultural and bilingual student recruitment, financial aid, and career services for progress towards degree completion and success after college. And they were able to create models of affordability by increasing student financial aid and housing remissions to enable qualified low-income students the opportunity of a university education. Thank you.
Thank you both. Great job. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, co-chairs, co-chair Monroe, co-chair Smith-Warner. I'll speak really, really quickly for the record. My name is Brian Fox, the Vice President for Finance at Oregon Tech, and beside me.
Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Fisher. I am a student at the University of Oregon.
And I want to make sure that Natalie has some time to talk. I think she's probably the most important person that you'll hear from today. You know, a lot of students really aren't the important folks. It's the students that we serve that are.
And Natalie, are you indeed the external vice president as well?
Yes, I am.
All right. So I'll walk through some slides really quickly here so that we're not lollygagging on anything. But this slide gives us an overview of where the governor's recommended budget is, where last year's legislatively approved budget is, and then even before the recession, or kind of headed into the recession in 2007-9. What you'll see is that in the far right-hand column, this is total investment in what we call education in general. That includes some sort of targeted state programs, but largely it's the Public University Support Fund. We have finally gotten back above where we were in 2007-2009, and that's not adjusted for inflation. So just to note, we're however many years, 6, 7, 8 years out, and we're basically flat to where we were back then, with significant increases in students, but also importantly significant increases in costs. And so that inflation factor is important. And if you stack that in, we are behind where we were. But despite that, we've made the sort of investments that you saw over the last kind of slides, because for us as institutions, as leaders of institutions, it is important that we serve our students and that we not just bring them in, but we get them through to completion. That is our focus, and to recognize that we're flat to where we were 8 years ago, and with another investment at that level, we will be flat to where we were a decade ago, despite significant cost increases. And the impact of that falls largely on the young lady beside me and her peers throughout the state. To the next slide. So this is a complex slide. I'll probably buzz over it a little bit, but I want to give a read to this group. I think it's important that you understand our budgets and what those pressures are. This will mirror the sort of pressure that you're seeing in other areas of state government. Just to be clear, we're all in this boat together. So the different colors represent sort of the stack of expenses at the institutions. The light blue on the bottom being salary. This is sort of what goes directly into folks' paycheck. And then the next three, the orange, gray, and yellow, those are benefits, OPE, other payroll expenses, the orange and gray being healthcare and retirement expense. And then on the top of that in dark blue is S&S, and then some other kind of smaller pieces, capital outlay, that kind of thing. What's important to note there is roughly 80% of our expenses are tied up with salary or salary and benefits. That's because what we do is we serve students with people. We want to make sure that we have low class sizes. I work at Oregon Tech. It was great to hear the positive words in Oregon Tech. Our secret sauce is pretty simple. We bring in highly qualified faculty. We focus on areas that are linked with industry, and we have small class sizes. That's the secret sauce. If we don't have investment, whether it comes from tuition and state appropriations, and those are fungible, those come together, it's one or the other, or we start to cut those things. Like, I'm a simple man. I think of things in pretty simple ways. We got three levers: increased investment from the state, increased investment in tuition, or decreases in costs. And because our cost base is people, that's where it comes in. And that S&S piece, it looks like that 20% chunk, can't really cut off the lights. Maybe able to shave a few paper clips, but there's not a lot there, right? There's just not a lot there. So it comes in, how do we serve people? How do we serve our students with people? Could you go back? Oh, sorry.
No, I don't know how.
I'll get you there, y'all. In the far right-hand bar is a note on how quickly costs are increasing, and so that slide was referenced earlier. And this is a piece of note. The areas where we have control, SNS and salary and pay, we are working as hard as we can to control those expenses. There are other areas where we have very limited control, and that is what is primarily driving what we anticipate to be somewhere between a 7.9 and 8.1% overall cost increase over the next biennia. The question that this comes to is who pays for that cost increase? So some of that will come through reductions, through efficiencies, through savings, but that won't take care of it all. And so the question really is, and I'll be honest, this is the hardest part of my job, right? I've been running a tuition process with our students, and I can remember when I was a student and working through a tuition process. It sucks. You're sitting there in front of a bunch of young people and you're saying, hey, here are the options. Either we reduce the quality of your education so that you're not getting what it is that you paid for, and that average salary right there will probably reduce because you're not getting the sort of service that you need, or we can increase tuition significantly, or the state can provide an investment. Those are really the options that are on the table. It's not pleasant. It's not pleasant to look at young folks and say, hey, we really need this. Our students, thankfully, have recognized the value of that investment and have been pretty supportive to recognizing that it's about quality for them. But my hope is that this group, in conjunction with the co-chairs, the rest of the legislature and the governor, can make a pretty significant investment. Can you move to the next slide? And I did, President Ray mentioned earlier, this $100 million isn't just a number that we created. It's not a pie-in-the-sky reinvestment. It is that number, the way that we got to it, is to sort of build up from the CSL that this group has heard of and the calculation that DAS has provided, which really treats us very much like a third party and not a part and not sort of not required or not having sort of the cost structure that are created through working through the state system, some minor adjustments that the HEC made. And then the sort of next piece, that $18 million kind of in the middle, is to maintain the proportion so that the state and students, kind of last year they were, I think, at 79% students or other than state and 21% state, that number may be a little off, that kind of carries forward. The additional $46.2 million, that's so that we're not shifting the costs of additional of PERS, PEB, other increases that are happening across the state budget, so that we're not off-putting those to students. We don't think that it is fair to have cost increases like that and hand the buck to the students. Don't think that that's fair. And that's what we're coming for, to say, how can we shield students? It's also important to note that $100 million investment is a large amount, but given the scale of the state budget, even without additional revenue, or even the education budget, that's a relatively small drop in the bucket that allows a group of Oregonians, a group of students, to move forward into their career. So I leave you with that, and we'll turn it over.
All right, and I have 1 minute, so I'll go fast. But so again, my name is Natalie. I'm actually from Bend, Oregon, so I am from east of the Cascades. I'm a senior at the University of Oregon studying political science, sociology, and Spanish. I'm also the external vice president of the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. So I guess I've actually spent more time here in Salem.
Natalie, can you just pull a little bit back from the mic?
Yeah, too loud? Okay.
Yeah, perfect.
thank you. Sorry. I have been in Salem more than I've been at home this past year talking with folks like you about what's going on, specifically about a request that equates to less than 0.5% of the state's budget that would assist in keeping college affordable for Oregon students. Even though I'm graduating next year, I refuse to let students be forgotten because we graduate every 4 years. And I am the only student here, but I think it's really important to note that for the past decade, through the decreased funding of the state of Oregon has asked students like myself to repeatedly pay more for less services, larger classroom numbers, and a decreasing range of academic programs. Last year, you all changed that trend with putting more money into the Public University Support Fund, and we're asking you to continue doing that today. As an in-state student, I've received multiple scholarships. And with this being my last term in college, I've actually officially reached my loan debt ceiling at $31,000, and that's just my undergraduate degree. So that's scary. But I wouldn't be able to afford the University of Oregon next year without quitting the ASUO, without quitting all the other extracurriculars that I've done that have actually led to me getting this job that I have next year, because I would have to work full time. A 10% increase is terrifying, but what's potentially exciting is the fact that you have the opportunity to cut that in half with our $100 million ask. But that's just the start. That's still a 5% increase for in-state students, still thousands of dollars for out-of-state students as well. This is not a model of higher education that the state of Oregon should be proud of. And I think there's a lot of work to do, and I'm happy to be here to do it, but I think there's so much that we can do together, and I'm really looking forward to hopefully seeing some money. Thank you.
Thank you, colleagues. Thank you all. Thanks to all the testifiers today. And with that, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 5524 and adjourn today's meeting. We'll see you all tomorrow. 5524 and adjourn.